the J-Talk Podcast. Yosh, 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 yosh.
Hello and welcome to the J-Talk Podcast. Ben Maxwell and Sam Robson with you. And Sam, if we thought match day one in the top flight was action-packed, well, match day two just said, hold my beer.
It absolutely did. The start of the season has been fantastic. I think we all thought it was going to be an open season, an exciting one, and it hasn't let us down yet. Some incredible games, some intriguing moments, and more of our discussion for us to get our teeth into this week.
Yes, VAR grabbing some headlines for a change as, match day two rolled around. It began on Friday night and it ran through Sunday afternoon. Some mixed weather up and down the country, but all the games were played. And as we said, very much action-packed. So on the match day two slate, there are actually no games between match day one winners this past weekend, as a total of 12 teams went looking for their first victories of the new season, and in the wash-up, three teams were successful in that mission, while a further three have a perfect slate after making it back-to-back wins on Saturday. So last week, Sam, we began with Shawnan's romp away at Tosu. On this pod, let's kick things off with plucky underdogs Kawasaki Frontale and their trip to Kashima. Again, action-packed. I think that's going to be the theme of this episode. For the second straight match day, Kawasaki had a player sent off, but this time, somehow, they ended up on the right end of a 2-1 scoreline.
Yes, somehow, is what you're saying. I mean, the end of this game is absolutely incredible. I don't think, once Yamamura was sent off, I don't think anyone was really seeing Kawasaki come back into it. Kashima had been fairly comfortable up until that point, and if anything, had had the better chances. And yeah, for that turnaround to happen and the events that led to that are just absolutely unbelievable. I mean, yeah, we could do an entire podcast on the final 15 minutes plus however many were added on. It said to go on forever. So yeah, let's try and sort through this.
Yeah, absolutely remarkable. So Frontale did the double over Antlers last season, for whatever that's worth. But with Jeziel suspended and Shintaro Kurumaya injured, Takuma Ominami and Kazuya Yamamura, formerly of Kashima, started in the centre of defence. And their makeshift back line was breached in just the fifth minute. Yuma Suzuki curling in a superb cross and ex-Frontale striker Kei Chinen making all Frontale fans' worst nightmare come true when he glanced in a brilliant header from the penalty spot past the dive of Jun Sung Ryong. So, yeah, the moment I think all Frontale supporters were dreading, Sam, the possibility of Chinen scoring against them. And, well, yeah, just like last week against F. Marinos, they were behind inside the first 5 minutes.
Yeah, they were, and it was really poor defending, as maybe was to be expected. Not just from that back line, but the space that Suzuki got when he dropped off and came in to cross the ball in, nobody got out to him. And maybe that was another part of their back line. Tachibanada had to go out to left back because Sasaki had a bit of illness, I think, during the week. So really, they didn't have him in front of that back line, so nobody went to press Suzuki, and when you give him time, he puts in a fantastic ball. And yeah, fair play to Chinen, it's a lovely header, and he celebrated that goal. Often players will not bother, they'll just put their hands up out of respect. I loved it for Chinen that he didn't bother with that. He absolutely loved that goal. He celebrated as if he'd won a cup final, and fair play to him. It was a terrific goal. Great start for Kashima, and yeah, you feared for Kawasaki at this point, given their defensive issues and going 1-0 down straight away.
Yeah, Chinen certainly made the most of his celebrations. It's a wonder he didn't just run over and stand right in front of a Toru Aniki and do the King Kazu dance or something. I mean, yeah, he obviously relished the moment and maybe letting out some frustration. I don't know. He's obviously taken to life at Kashima very well with goals in his first two league games for them. But I guess the pattern of the game, at least until the red card came inside the last 10 minutes, Sam, was just utter domination of the ball by Kawasaki. I mean, they had 75% possession in this game. They played over a total of 700 passes, according to the official stats. And did you see the stat flash up on the screen at the end of the game? The top 10 passes in the game were all Frontale players.
Yeah, I did. That is quite incredible, really. But it does show that Kashima just sat in, and Kawasaki weren't as used. Like last week, they went over the top a fair bit, or at least went through quite quickly against Marinos. This time, they were forced to have to play the ball around. And it's kind of what they were doing last season, where they had a lot of the ball, but just weren't able to, or weren't dynamic enough to really create anything. Like, for all the ball they had, Hayakawa didn't have to make too many saves. He didn't really have to get involved too often, and that backline for Kashima were fairly comfortable, to be honest. Yes, they had a lot of the ball, but yeah, didn't, maybe they lacked, I don't know, that DeAndre Damian, that's a player that you can just play the ball up to and go a little bit different and mix up your play a little bit more, and they didn't really have that. Yes, they looked decent enough in possession, but I felt for the most part Kashima were quite comfortable and probably had the better chance.
Well, yeah, Ikuma Sekigawa's free header from a corner was just too close to Jung 10 minutes into the second half. But yes, he could have given Antlers some breathing room there. And then, the game continued. Kawasaki continued to dominate the ball until the 83rd minute, when Kazuya Yamamura was finally shown a straight red card after a VAR review. You've very kindly sent me the clip in the green room, Sam, because the zone highlights package I saw today only showed the referee returning from his VAR check and whipping out the red card to Yamamura to send him off. So I think I'll be gracious here and let you state your opinion first. I've only just seen the clip in the green room and I'm still piecing it together myself. But which way do you lie on this Yamamura red card for a dog show?
Yeah, so I don't agree with this decision. I don't know what you think yet. We'll find out in a bit. But it's given as a foul on the field, and it's like it puts his arm out. I think it's a foul. It's quite soft, really. There's not a lot of contact, but it is a foul. It stops Nakama getting past Yamamura. But for me, Seko is sprinting to the left-hand side. So if Nakama hasn't got to go past Yamamura and just runs through, I think it's a contested ball when they both get there. I don't think it's absolutely an obvious goal-scoring opportunity. Plus, with it VAR reviewed, I know that it's never clear and obvious, but I don't think it is clear and obvious that Nakama gets to the ball first and then has the shot on goal. I think with Seko coming back, it's contested, and I don't agree with the decision. I think it's telling that neither highlights package that we've gone for have shown this decision, because usually in my experience is when they've got it wrong. So I didn't agree with it. I thought it was a harsh decision. And it was just one that Nishimura kind of likes the attention, I think, but went across and took his time and milked it. But yeah, I know Alan disagrees with me, a qualified referee, so maybe I'm in the minority here. So what do you think, Ben?
Well, I couldn't have said it better myself, Sam. Yes, we didn't thrash this out in the green room. We purposely waited until we hit record. But yes, I agree. I don't think while he is by about half a yard, the last man, by the time a contact is made with Nakama, yes, I think the covering defender is making enough ground to, as you say, make it a contested ball. And for me, I think the foul should stand, but I don't think it's any worse than that. And indeed, in other areas of the pitch, I'm not sure that would even be given as a foul. And Nakama runs into Yamamura, who gets across him. I mean, he should probably leg it a bit quicker than he does. He's a bit casual in his approach there, Yamamura. But yes, for me, I don't agree with the red card decision. All that did is just set up what came later even more remarkable, Sam, because down to 10 men inside the last 10 minutes, we should say the last 10 minutes of the 90, because yes, added time went for almost 15 full minutes. So there was an awful lot of football still to be played and so much more drama to come after Yamamura was ultimately shown his red card. And the 10 men of Kawasaki equalized in the 89th minute when the young striker Shin Yamada leapt to volley home his first J1 goal. It's certainly one he'll never forget. And yes, all of the traveling Frontale supporters will never forget as well, I'm sure. As much for Yamada's volley as for Akihiro Ienaga's spectacular bicycle kick assist, Sam.
Oh, unbelievable. For a guy of 36 years old, I don't think I'd have got up again after producing that over a kick. But yeah, it was magnificent. I hope he intends it to be a pass because it's glorious. Yeah, it's poor header out to start with. But once it comes back to Iheanacho, great technique on the ball across. And Yamada does really well, but it's not the easiest of finishes to be able to turn it in at the height it arrives to him at. So yeah, really good goal. They'll be cursing themselves, Kashima, for not dealing with a set piece and to be done by Kawasaki at a set piece. But I think as goals from set pieces go, this was a good quality one.
Yeah, absolutely. And as, just as a bit of a sidebar here, yeah, Ominami was involved there heading across for Iheanacho's bicycle kick. So we know that, yes, he and Yamamura's backline was breached inside the first 5 minutes. We know that Yamamura was sent off with nine minutes to go. But overall, yeah, Ominami, I don't think we're especially positive about his arrival from Kashiwa and what that would mean to Kawasaki's back line. I mean, he himself, I think, played over 100 passes in this game. But overall, as you said earlier, Kawasaki dominated the ball, but Kashiwa were content to sit in. So did Ominami actually do much defensively in his first league start for Frontale?
He didn't have to do too much. I don't think Kashiwa really threatened too greatly. There were a couple of occasions, I don't think it's just Ominami, I think it's just across the board with that back line. There were occasions where there was a lack of organisation, but it was such a hodgepodge of defenders in there, you can understand why maybe they didn't know exactly where to be. Maybe, like, especially marking from corners, nobody knew exactly who to pick up. Eventually, nobody picked up Sekigawa. And there were a few occasions like that as like a collective issue, but Ominami himself, very good on the ball. He's used to playing in more of a back three, which I think opens it up to being more progressive. He played right wing back a lot for Kashiwa last week. So I think in terms of being on the ball and being able to start I think he's very capable. And yeah, generally speaking, like Kawasaki are often in this position where they have to play random centre backs, and usually they get away with it and they get by, and Yamamura does fine. Ominami looks like he could come in, and you're not going to be too worried necessarily if he has to step in for the occasional game. He looked absolutely fine.
Rightio, and yeah, he'll have Jezeel back alongside him in match day three. So yes, that'll be some comfort for him, I'm sure. So yes, sidebar concluded. We can carry on with what came throughout stoppage time. It was absolutely mental. So the Kashima home support was stunned by Yamada's 89th minute equaliser, but there was still so much more to come. A ruck in the box in the 94th minute. First, Daiya Tono's blast was blocked inside the 6-yard box. Then Kento Tachibana's follow-up was blocked on the line by Ryotaro Araki, with the referee, Mr. Nishimura, pointing straight to the spot for handball and sending Araki off. Okay, so here is the other, two of three major VAR decisions that we have to chat about in this game, Sam. There's still another one to come shortly, but I said to you in the green room, this is why I wouldn't never want to be a referee or a VAR, because having to make the judgment whether the ball hit Araki's shoulder or whether it hit far enough down his arm to justify the red card for handball is really difficult, especially when we don't see the perfect angle. We have to hope the VAR sees more than we do, but I let you go first on the other one. I think overall the referee has made his decision, so I don't think there is a clear and obvious error to say, no, the ball definitely came off Araki's shoulder, not his arm. So I think by the letter of the law, the decision has to stand, and Mr. Nishimura has made the judgment on the pitch. So, yes, Kashima can feel hard done to. If there is a magic angle out there that we haven't seen, that it shows the ball hit enough of Araki's shoulder. But for me, I think it's right that the decision ultimately stands. How about you?
Yeah, I like that we were completely on the same page again here. It's very nice to see. I think whatever Nishimura gave, I think he has to stay with that decision, because unless there is another angle from the far side looking in, which is what we needed, there's one angle that looks like it's shoulder first. There's one angle that looks like it's slightly lower down. But then again, where's the cutoff between shoulder and arm for a handball? I'm not it seems to change on a weekly basis, and other refs deem it differently. But he does throw the arm out to a degree, so I can understand why he gives the decision initially, because it does look like he thrusts to make himself a bit bigger. I think it is harsh on Araki that he's given the red card for it. Obviously, he has to if he thinks it's a handball, but I think it is maybe more shoulder, but there's nothing conclusive to say either way. So, yeah, he has to go with the on-field decision, and, yeah, unlucky for Ryotaro Araki.
Yes, indeed. But yeah, wait, there's more when it comes to VAR. We know Iyanaga is often appears very casual on the pitch. And, if it ultimately had, of course, Kawasaki 2 points, I mean, the way that Iyanaga just rolled his penalty straight into the waiting arms of Tomoki Hayakawa, who guessed right to his right, then, I think Iyanaga might have been walking home. But another VAR check detected encroachment, and whether it was whether it was encroachment of players from both teams into the box as Iyanaga walked up to take his spot kick, or whether it was Hayakawa jumping off his line, I don't know whether that was actually confirmed in the final VAR judgment, Sam, but the penalty was ordered retaken, and then Iyanaga dinked down the middle in the 11th of what turned out to be 15 minutes of stoppage time. So did we get any final clarification about why the penalty was retaken?
I've not seen any certain clarification. At least on screen, the graphic was saying it was for defensive encroachment, but like both teams had encroached. So, and I don't know, the Premier League likes to do things its own way because it thinks it's a bit better than everyone else. But their ruling is on defensive encroachment, it's only if that encroacher then gets the ball, the rebound, and then clears it away. So like if this is just saved, as it was very tamely by the goalkeeper, then the Premier League would have carried on if it was for encroachment. There is also the point of view that maybe Hayakawa is off his line at the time, and I think he is as he makes the save. So I think it should have been retaken for the goalkeeper being off his line rather than the encroachment. And I think it's maybe just an issue with the graphic that they haven't changed the wording on it correctly. But I think it has to be retaken. Although it was that bad a penalty, I think he probably should have not had the chance to take it again.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, he should have been punished for that by, having to remember that moment for the rest of his career, because to say that was casual is a massive understatement. But yes, so Iyanaga's 101st minute winner has turned out to be Kawasaki's first 3 points of the season. And imagine being an Antlers fan, taking the lead in the fifth minute, and then seeing your side ultimately go down some of that shambles. It was absolutely remarkable game. In many respects, it's almost impossible to take anything meaningful from it, I think, because it was so manic there in the last 7 minutes of normal time, and then all 15 minutes of added time. But Frontale they had to have the 3 points, and they somehow got it. The 10 men returned to Kanagawa, and would have been a fun bus ride home for them, I'm sure. As it would have been, as I try to segue on to the next game, for the Niigata players on their return from Hiroshima after they also won away by a 2-1 scoreline. And Sam, Niigata drew rave reviews for their performance at Cerezo Osaka last week on their top flight return, and they really looked the part in the first half, especially away at Hiroshima on Sunday. You described it in our line group and on Twitter as the most impressive half of football you had seen from any J1 side so far in this young J1 season.
Yeah, absolutely. And maybe I'm slightly biased towards orange teams, as it seems that is the case then whenever I big up a team. But I thought Niigata were magnificent, especially in the first half. Because Hiroshima, their pressing is so good, and very few teams dealt with it last season. And after a little bit of time in the first couple of minutes, they were so good at playing it out in Niigata. They were so comfortable in possession. They were so confident in taking it away. And then once they did, and got it to Ryotaro Ito, who was magnificent in this game. Every time he received the ball, under pressure, he'd be able to turn away. He'd be able to look, know where everyone is around him. He had such a map of the play. He would then find Mito, find Ota. He'd be involved in absolutely everything. And they took Hiroshima apart in this first half. And it was just a joy to watch. I mean, Mito, and Ito, their combinations were so good. Ota on the end of things, I think he obviously scored one, a terrific goal, hit the post with another. Suzuki in general was, I think he's maybe the weak link of that kind of four there, but he still, his movement was pretty good. He got his goal as well. So I just thought they were absolutely magnificent. And even in the second half, when Hiroshima really turned it up and went at them, they played extra players up front, because there was a lot of questions about, is this defence going to hold tight enough? And they managed to. They were under so much pressure, but got through that game. So, yeah, it was just a really impressive performance.
Yeah, outstanding. So, yeah, Albirex went in front, went in at halftime, rather, 2-0 up, thanks to goals from Shusuke Ota and Koji Suzuki. Ota's was a first-time rasper from the edge of the D off the fingertips of Keisuke Osako on his J1 debut, no less, and in the 14th minute, that was, I should have said. And, well, in between Ota's opener in the 14th minute and Koji Suzuki making it 2-0 in the 37th, the woodwork was hit at both ends. Yoshifumi Kashiwa somehow hit the bar from about a yard out for the hosts. Then Alter, yeah, as Sam's mentioned, curled against the post. And then Keisuke Osako tipped the outstanding Ryotaro Ito's shot against the bar before Alter squared for Suzuki to tap in, yes, 8 minutes before halftime. Michael Skipper made three changes at the break, Sam. So what did they do? What did those changes do to improve Hiroshima's second half performance? Because I mean, they dominated the second half chances, there's no doubt about that, before Tsukasa Shiotani set up a grandstand finish by channeling his inner Emil Salomonsen by volleying home spectacularly from the edge of the box in the 79th minute. So yeah, what did those changes do to improve Hiroshima in the second half?
It kind of got them higher up the pitch. It got Niigata under a lot of pressure, especially putting Sotirio up front alongside Ben Khalifa. It meant that both centre-backs for Niigata were kind of engaged with. They both had something to deal with. Then in behind that, you had the likes of Morishima, who also came on playing well. Kawamura was there as well, so it was a lot of attacking quality. Mitsuta was out on the right wing, in right wing-back position, but his delivery was so dangerous. And Higashi, likewise, his delivery almost caught out Kojima, I think the first 5 minutes, across that Kojima has to tip away. So, yeah, it was just about putting so much pressure, so many bodies further forward, increasing the intensity of the press, which eventually kind of broke Niigata down. They eventually couldn't quite get out as easily as they did in the first half. And, yeah, they just had a lot of half chances, really. They didn't necessarily create too much clear cut. And yeah, Niigata have to take a lot of credit for being able to deal with it for as long as they did. Yeah, it was just that extra pressure, and it made for a really fascinating second half.
Yeah, and a stunner from Shiotani. We certainly know that he's got that in his locker, and yes, and a spectacular volley, no question about that. Yeah, I mean, as regular listeners know, I often have issues with the shot counts from varying sources. The J-League had this 22-7 in favour of Hiroshima, but if you do a Google search, it's a 27-9. So, yeah, I think the second number maybe sums up the action-packed nature of this game a little bit better. But our boys, Hiroshima, Sam, we both tipped them for the title in our J-Preds. And after match day two, we certainly know that they got gypped out of a goal last week against Sapporo. And the J-League referees have come out and admitted their mistake that, Hiroshima were denied a legitimate goal last week. And then, this performance, which obviously carried a threat at times and saw them score a terrific goal, but they still they sit after match day two with just a point. But I imagine Michael Skipper won't be pushing too many alarm bells this early doors.
No, I'm not sure how much he subscribes to XG, but that must be through the roof for Hiroshima. After the first two games, the amount of chances they've missed, the amount of chances from close range that they've missed. So that is a slight concern. I said it last week, and again here, especially the Kashiwa one, I don't know how he's possibly hit the bar from there. That's the most difficult thing he could have done from that position. But so they've had I think you'll be happy that they're creating the chances, they're having the pressure. It's just that finishing touch is really lacking. I think having Morishima back for this second half, and hopefully for them starting in the next game, is definitely going to help. And yeah, it's just kind of one of those things, I think. They've had so many chances. There's no way they should be sitting with just the 1 point, I don't think, from the way that they've played. And it sets up an incredibly interesting game on Friday against Yokohama, because you don't want to be 7 points down on Yokohama after three games. I suppose if you're 7 points down from at any stage of the season, then you want it to be the third game. But it kind of sets it up as a really interesting game. And it's a game that last season, as well as they played against most teams against Yokohama, I think they beat them 3-0 and were quite comfortable. And they're one of the teams that can play through this press. So it would be a concern if more teams were as good as that, or as good as Niigata were here at that. But I think, generally speaking, their press is going to cause so many problems. So, yeah, it's not panic stations yet. Just, yeah, need to find a bit more of a clinical nature in front of goal. But maybe Sotiriu coming back as well, because he missed a fair chunk of pre-season through injury. So he got 45 minutes. So those are reasonable signs for them. Yeah, it's just another one of those days. But I don't think they'll come across a team as good as Niigata were in that first half very often.
Right, yes. And you're right, yeah, it's a blockbuster on Friday night. Yes, between the two teams, I tipped to find out the title in my JPred. So, again, huge kudos to Niigata. And, yes, their supporters finally get to watch their boys in orange at home at the Big Swan in J1 this coming Saturday when they host Sapporo. And after scoring, two goals in each of their first two J1 games, well, yes, Sapporo do tend to be hospitable visitors at times. So we'll certainly wait and see what Albedex get up to in their home opener. All right, so also tasting victory for the first time in 2023, and also by a 2-1 scoreline, were Avispa Fukuoka, who entertained Cerezo Osaka at the Best Denki Stadium on Saturday. They welcome back their former player, Jordy Crooks. I say welcome back in inverted commas. I think he got a bit of a mixed reception, but a lot of Avispa supporters still obviously have fond memories of Crooks in their kit. But they weren't particularly hospitable hosts ultimately, Fukuoka. They did leave it late, but that man Takeshi Kanemori came off the bench, Sam, to glance in a superb header that won it for them in the 88th minute. Obviously, there's a lot more in that game that we can talk about in the meantime, but a terrific moment for Kanemori, and indeed the fans behind the goal as he raced off to celebrate with them.
Yeah, not a typical Kanemori goal at all, either. It's a glancing header. He's much known for having the ball at his feet. But yeah, it summed up the different approach that Avispa had in this game. They, when they were at their best, not last season, the season before, it was through their crossing from wide. And that's what they did a lot more of in this game that they hadn't done the previous week. And I think Yuzawa, especially on the right-hand side, was magnificent in this game. The way that his energy up and down the field, but also his delivery. I think the first one, or the main one I can remember, is the one he crossed for his fellow wing back Oda, and he almost as bad as, in fact, it was probably worse than Kashua's effort, actually. He was fairly close in and blazed over, but that was a really good chance. But they were just more aggressive against Cerezo than they usually are. There was a lot more impetus going forward, and yeah, fair play to them for finally, well, keeping going till the end, because you'd think a typical Avispa performance at 1-1 going into the end of the game might just sit back and try and take a 1-1 draw against Cerezo, but they absolutely went for it and got their rewards.
Yeah, exactly. That's very well put, Sam. Yeah, so Avispa went in front at 2 minutes after the break when Cerezo were punished for a loose square ball by Ryuya Nishio. Yuya Yamagishi surged through the center and played in Lukian, who squared for the veteran midfielder Hiroyuki Mae to tap into an empty net. I think we can give Lukian the benefit of the doubt there, Sam, that he was passing. As we know, most of last year he couldn't hit a barn door. But, I think we can probably both agree that he was passing rather than trying to shoot there. So fair play to Lukian, and assist under his belt early doors here in this young season. And Mai, the veteran, as I said, with a great goal for him that he celebrated heartily, no question about that. Shortly after that, Hiroaki Okuno struck the outside of the post from 30 yards as a Cerezo looked to hit back, and they equalized just before the hour in superb style as a Satoki Wajo smashed in a shot off the underside of the bar after fine work cutting in from the right by Seiya Maekuma. And well, yeah, Wajo, cool as a cucumber, Sam. I mean, he must just knock those in his sleep, because it was, yeah, he did hardly celebrate it at all, did he? He just sauntered his way back to the center circle. Yeah, he's, I guess he's just used to scoring specials like those.
Well, I guess so, yeah. I wasn't sure why he was so upset with everything. I don't know what was going on, but it was a terrific goal. The drop of the shoulder to get away from his man and a perfect strike into the top corner. It was a fantastic goal. I don't know if he was just looking across and he saw Kagura was coming on and then, yeah, okay, that's me done. Okay, fine. There's nothing I can do, even if I'm scoring like goals like this, I'm coming off. So maybe that got him, but it was a fantastic goal. And I've liked Wager for ages. Like last season, I don't think he necessarily got the game time that his quality deserved. There were a few injuries in there that maybe curtailed that a little bit. But yeah, he came in, missed last week, but came in here and I thought he looked fantastic. His footwork was always good. And that drop of the shoulder, it just did for a number of tip players on a couple of occasions in this game. And a couple of times Nagaishi was maybe equal to the shot, but yeah, it wasn't getting anywhere near this. A terrific strike.
Yeah, brilliant stuff. And I did check. Yeah, Wajo has never played for Fukuoka, but I don't know. Maybe he grew up a Hisashi Jogo fan or something. But yeah, he likes playing against Avispa. He scored against them in one of the meetings between these two teams last year. And yeah, it was a spectacular goal. No question about that. As I said, equalizing just before the hour. Sam's mentioned Shinji Kagawa. He came on shortly after, and then in the 77th minute, he controlled a ball in from Maekuma and volleyed on target on the turn, but a Avispa keeper Takumi Nagaishi parried clear. And yes, it was to be two Fukuoka subs who settled matters with 2 minutes left. As we've mentioned, it was a Yota Maijima who crossed from the left, and yes, Kanemori glanced in his header and yeah, made sure to celebrate with all of the fans behind the goal. So yeah, terrific moment for him and for the Avispa faithful, no question about that. And again, quite a bit of a goalkeeper hokey-cokey going on after two match days, Sam. Murakami started last week for Fukuoka, but Nagaishi came in this week. A number of clubs made the switch this week, and I'm not sure if you put it down to anything, or is it horses for courses, or maybe Nagaishi was the preferred starter all along but wasn't quite ready after pre-season. I don't know.
Yeah, I'm not sure, to be honest. Last season, they did a little bit of this in and out for periods of the season. I think Murakami, was he voted or at least a nominee for a player of the half season, and then almost immediately got dropped for Nagaishi? So, yeah, he's used to a bit of rotation. Maybe his horses for courses, because Murakami didn't do anything particularly wrong last week that I can really think of. So, yeah, interesting. But Nagaishi, I thought, played pretty well, saved what he could save, and, yeah, had no chance with the Awejo goal.
Indeed, indeed. All right, so yeah, Fukuoka, first 3 points of the season for them. Very welcome indeed. And yeah, well, Cerezo find themselves in the same boat as Hiroshima, basically, don't they? Yes, a draw in their first game and then a defeat in their second. And yes, a number of people obviously had Cerezo in their top four, and some people even have them winning J1 in their J-preds. But yes, not pushing too many panic buttons quite yet, I don't think. All right then, so they are the three teams who won for the first time in match day two, Kawasaki, Niigata, and Fukuoka. Their games rounded up. We will take a quick break, and then we'll return to talk about the three clubs who are a perfect two wins from two. Welcome back. And next to one of the big fixtures on paper, without question, in match day two, was the defending champions Yokohama F. Marinos hosting Urawa Reds at the Nissan Stadium, and a bumper crowd of over 34,000 was in attendance. Of course, F. Marinos won this corresponding fixture 4-1 at the end of last season, putting the title back firmly in their grasp after a couple of games worth of wobble there. Elber and Anderson Lopez both bagged braces in that fixture, and after the former struck the post from close range in the 14th minute, the latter opened the scoring 4 minutes later, rising to head home from inside the six-yard box after Takuma Nishimura had squared across the area. So, F. Marino's looking pretty ominous early doors, Sam. And yes, if they can get Anderson Lopez in regular goal-scoring form, then I think the rest of the league better look out.
Yeah, especially if they play the way they did first 20-25 minutes. I think this was Yokohama towards their best. I thought the move to get Lopez's goal is just magnificent. I think Lopez, in fact, starts it to Elbert. It goes out to Nagato, crossed in, Nishimura across, then to Lopez. Wonderfully worked. And yeah, I just thought first half, that first 25 minutes or so, yeah, they were just really, really good. Elbert hit the post. He probably should have done a little bit better. They worked one to Matsubara that forced a decent save. But yeah, they just pinned Reds in for that opening salvo. And yeah, really good. They let them in though after that. I thought Reds, but the problem is Reds were just, I don't want to be horrible to them, but they were just dull. They had the ball and didn't do anything with it. They didn't have any pace in the team. I think taking out Junker and Matsuo and Esaka has really hamstrung them. And I don't know whether it's the manager as well kind of putting the handbrake on a little bit, but they just don't seem like they're able to go past the defence. Like, Linson is okay in pockets, and generally the wingers all cut in and they're okay at playing it out and they can control the ball. But it says something when Kuroki, whatever he is, 36, 37, comes on and was able to give a spark and was the first one to go beyond the defence. So, yeah, I just think it was not a great Reds performance. And Yokohama, I thought, after getting the lead, were just quite comfortable and played a little bit within themselves.
Right, yeah, it sounds like they were straight out of the gate in a similar vein to last week at Kawasaki. And, they obviously got their reward in that game early on. And same again here against Reds, who, weren't put to bed by F. Marino's until very late on. So they were still in this game, and Reds' chances were at a premium. But Yoshio Koizumi fired into the side netting 10 minutes after the break when he might have done better, and obviously he would have loved to have done better. Again, Sam, I'm not sure how many shots on target they've actually had over the course of their first two games. Of course, they've played two games away from home, the same as Niigata. But Albirex returning home for their home opener this coming Saturday with 4 points in the bank. Reds have not scored and, have nil pois to show for their efforts. So I think I've asked you a couple of times already whether any teams, a certain team should be pushing alarm bells or not. It is still too early to make a sweeping judgment about Reds, but I think their supporters maybe will have hoped for better. I think we can say that for sure, can't we?
Oh, definitely. And there are concerns. I think generally the team is from the back line is pretty good. And then the midfield, I like Iwao and Ito and Koizumi is good. It's just that attack, there's just no X factor in it. And Moberg's a good player, but only kind of you know what he's going to do. He's going to cut in on his left foot. It's quite slow. There's nobody that's going to go beyond. I know they're still looking for a striker. Giacomakis hasn't worked out. Whoever I said last week, Kante, he has not materialised. They haven't. And if they don't really have an option at the moment. Now, Takahashi's not made either squad for whatever reason. He seems like more of the profile that would help out. I think also the other one would be Akimoto, who played up front in J2, and for whatever reason he's now a left back, even though you've got Ohata and Ogiwara, who could also play a left back. So maybe it's just moving one like Akimoto further forward, bringing in Takahashi just to liven up that attack. But because at the moment it's quite comfortably what they're going to do, and you can funnel them into the centre and they're just not going to do anything. So in both games they've had reasonable possession up until the 18 yard box, but at no stage in either game have they looked like scoring. So even in this game, the most threatened they looked was when Sakai made a crossfield run from right back to get onto a long ball. That's where the Koizumi chance came from, and they did that a couple of times. But you can't be relying on a long ball to your right back coming across to the left wing to really be the main avenue of attack. So, and they need to sort things out. Obviously, it's just, at the moment, I just don't see where their goals are coming from. But there is quality in the team, and then maybe it's just that one addition whenever they can bring him in. that does spark this team into the life. Because at the moment, as I say, and I don't want to say this about Reds because it's not usually the word I'd use for them, but they're quite dull to watch.
Disappointing first two match days, no question about that. And as you said earlier, I mean, you take those three names out of the team, even though Asaka wasn't particularly effective last year, and obviously Juncker was in and out of the team under Ricardo Rodriguez, but it's still taking to life, I guess, under Maciej Skorża. And he'll hope his Saitama Stadium bow on Saturday will bring the Reds' first positive result of the season, no doubt about that. So, well, yes, Reds were in the game until the 89th minute when F. Marino's substitute Jan Mateus killed them off. A Marcos Jr. flick released Nishimura, who claimed another assist, squaring for Jan Mateus, who had time to pick his spot before firing home. So, there you go. F. Marino's joint top with the team we're going to come on to next. Kobe made it two wins from two. They headed up to the Sapporo Dome on Saturday afternoon. I mean, they didn't win too many games last year, Sam, but they did do the double over Consadole. And, I guess they don't mind playing against them, as they made it three wins on the spin with what turned out to be an action-packed, there's that word again, but I guess ultimately comfortable 3-1 away win up at the Dome.
Yeah, very, very comfortable. I thought Vissel were very good and Sapporo very, very poor. And the work of Muto and Osako, although Muto, I'll get this out of the way because I like Muto, but he could still be playing now and wouldn't score in this game. For whatever reason, it was just off for him. But his passing to Osako is very good, and I think he played in Yamaguchi later, so he was still contributing despite not being able to hit a barn door in this game. But yeah, it was really comfortable for Kobe. Sapporo gave them a lot of space to work into, very little pressure, and Sapporo themselves did not look like they were going to attack with anything. They were playing, and Arano went up front, why Kim Gunhee, if you're that down on your striker that you're going to drop him after one game, And why didn't you sign someone in the winter? Why have you not got anyone? Why isn't Nakashima up there? Because playing like a midfielder there, it's not like it's a wonderful Spanish version of the false nine where his movement is really dragging players around and they're getting in and around him. It was just extra stodged, really. That's what it was. And they didn't look like they were going to attack. And when you were supposed to be a really attacking team, stunting that doesn't make any sense, and they couldn't rely on their defence. It was just far too easy for Kobe, but I think a lot of credit has to go to Kobe as well to get away with two victories out of the first two games, given their defence is in complete tatters. Like, they were playing Hatase, Honda, Yamakawa and Ino, and you'd say at least three of those wouldn't make their regular back four. So for them to have been so comfortable with that, and it's very rare you say that about Kobe as well, defensively comfortable. So, yeah, really good performance from them. And Sapporo, at the moment, a lot of Reds have been really poor, but I think Sapporo might be the team I'm worried about the most, because they have not looked good in either game. They've not really had a period in either game where they've looked like they're capable of challenging their opponent. So, yeah, really disappointing for them. They need to kick into gear, but it's looking good for Kobe. But, I mean, this is Kobe, so it could all go completely wrong next week.
Well, that's right. Yeah, two wins from two, but they won't be counting any chickens there after their shenanigans of last season. Yeah, TD in our line group is a Sapporo fan, and he was ready to eat his hat, I think, after Saturday's exertions from his side. Really frustrating afternoon at the office for Consadole. I mean, they did have the ball in the net in just the fifth minute through Ryota Aoki, but he was flagged for a hairline offside. I mean, he looked level to me on the replay, but I'll take VAR's word for it, and indeed the linesman who flagged in the first place anyway. But then, yes, the visitors went ahead 4 minutes later when Yoshinori Muto, who, as Sam's mentioned, could not literally hit a barn door on Saturday, but did end up with the two assists. He won the ball back out by the touchline and fed Yuya Osaka, who drove home superbly past Gu Sung Yun, who was another keeper who was inserted into the starting lineup this week, with Sugano out of the squad. Gu returned to the Sapporo lineup for the first time since match day one in 2020. But unfortunately for him, he was picking the ball out of his net a total of three times in this game. Daiju Sasaki doubled Kobe's advantage just before the hour. He was found by Osako on the right side of the box. He curled home after his initial shot had come straight back to him off Gu's legs. And then Hotaro Yamaguchi made it three late on when he rolled home following a lovely Muto assist. Sapporo saved a smidgen of face at the death with a penalty by Takuro Kaneko after he was hauled down by Takahiro Ogihara. But Sapporo on the wrong end of a 3-1 scoreline. And there you go. Yes, they couldn't follow up their goalless draw away at Hiroshima when they somehow, and well, they didn't actually keep them out, did they? But yes, according to the official records, that ended up 0-0. And yes, they've returned home and gotten spanked by Kobe. On Saturday, it was maybe not quite as one-sided at the Toyota Stadium, but ultimately Nagoya defeated Kyoto to make it two wins from two themselves. Grampus were winning 1-0 for the second straight week. This came against a Kyoto side who looked to bolster their goal threat by starting with the Patrick and Kazunari Ichimi up top, along with Yuta Toyokawa. Sam, I know that Patrick had a couple of good chances in the second half, but it did appear from the highlights it took a while for Kyoto's new look front line to gel.
Yeah, it did. They didn't really have a great understanding, which is maybe understandable, but it was better. Like, they weren't very good in the first game, but the second game, yeah, Patrick, at least it's kind of spearheaded them. He got a couple of chances, maybe a little bit lucky with the way that one or two fell to him, but yeah, he looked a bit more of a threat. There were shots on goal. It looked like, okay, there is a chance of this team scoring a goal, which there wasn't in the first match. But eventually they got going. But I think it was only Patrick. I don't think Ichimi played particularly well. Toyokawa was quite busy, but maybe ineffective. So it was mainly Patrick. So they've still got a lot to do to work out the best way to get around him. But I think it was quite clear in this game to me that Patrick should be the figurehead rather than Yamasaki, who I don't think offers too much. But then, can you rely on a 35-year-old Patrick to be playing every game? Because you saw how Utaka got burnt out last year. So yeah, there's still plenty of questions to answer. They've got a lot of players. We haven't seen anything of Kosuke Kinoshita, who scored 12 goals last season, so that's an interesting one. Maybe if he's injured, he can come in and maybe bolster it to a degree. But yeah, there are still issues there. There weren't anything massively clear-cut, and when Langerak was equal to anything that they threw Patrick threw it in.
Mm. Yeah, fair enough. So we know that Kasper Juncker got Nagoya's winner last week against Yokohama FC. Well, he was the provider for the winner on Saturday. He set up Kensuke Nagai, his strike partner, in the 62nd minute after Takuji Yonemoto fizzed a pass into Juncker. His cushioned layoff found Nagai, whose first-time shot went in off the keeper, Tomoya Wakahara, and went off the inside of the keeper's left-hand post. So, I guess Grampus won't mind if we don't spend an awful amount of time chatting about them, Sam. I mean, they're still a work in progress themselves, obviously. And Mateus wasted a few chances here. So, I don't know, maybe Grampus's next opponents need to beware of the threat from him, perhaps even more than they would otherwise be, as it maybe it's his turn to score after Juncker notched in match day one and Nagai has scored here. We know, the threat that all three players can have, and if they do ultimately gel and make themselves into a proper strike force, then the rest of the league will have to look out. But for the time being, as you can, I suppose, if you're two wins from two, Grampus won't mind a flying under the radar somewhat.
No, they won't. That is kind of what they're doing. They're just doing enough to get through games. I thought the movement from their guy as he dummied it first, as it went into Juncker and then got on the end of it, that was good to see, good understanding. But yeah, they were sort of limited in how threatening they were. And they can do that, I suppose, when they've got a defence as good as Nagoya's is, and then occasionally if that's breached, they've got the best goalkeeper in the league behind them, then they're able to just kind of sit through games and soak pressure, and that's kind of what they did. I still think their midfield needs a little bit of work in terms of being able to find that front three a little bit easier, because they give the ball away far too much in there. So, and you can tell once you get it to the attacking players, they are going to create something. That's where they differ from Reds at the moment, in terms of that front three can't really do anything, but their midfield is decent enough to keep possession. So, but yeah, it was okay. I'm not blown away by Nagoya at the moment, but with that front three, you think eventually they can kick into gear. So to be able to get through and get 1-0 victories, I think that's perfect for them at the moment.
Yes, indeed. All right, then. So three teams winning for the first time in part one, three teams making it two wins from two in part two. And after a quick hit of music, we'll be back with part three to chat about the three draws from J1 Match Day 2. Welcome back. Of course, we led off last week's episode by talking about Sean and Belmari's win down at Tosu, and they entered match day two as the table toppers, but unfortunately for them, they came up against a determined opponent in their home opener at the Lemon Gas Stadium on Friday night in a Kanagawa derby. Yokohama FC rocked up to the Lemon Gas Stadium and certainly gave Shonan a game, Sam. This ultimately was to be a tale of two strikers, the two number 18s, and a wavy-haired left-back who, we'll be seeing on the blooper reels for decades to come.
Oh, God. What? I don't know. I'm not going to start with the words. Because that could be in its own podcast because it's just ridiculous. But, yeah, the other two strikers, I thought both of them were absolutely incredible in this game. Ogawa, last week, I wasn't impressed with him. And I don't know if he heard the podcast. I don't know if things were pinned up on the dressing room wall. But he started incredibly well. And Yokohama FC, straight out of the blocks. I think they scored within 12 seconds. So, I don't know what the ruling is because it was VAR-reviewed forever. Does it still go down as a 12-second goal, or does it go in once VAR decides it goes in? Because they flagged it offside. But, yeah, it was really nicely worked once it was put up there. Ogawa starting it, getting the ball back. Yeah, a lovely finish. And, yeah, it was, as you say, a tale of two strikers. Both of them looked really good. Machino's first goal is so good. Ohashi got his hat-trick last week. His nod down to Machino. And the way he cuts in on his left foot and finishes, absolutely superb. So that was the quality of the opening opening proceedings. But yeah, I'll let you talk through what was going through Takuya Wada's mind in the 23rd minute.
Well, yeah, don't worry, we'll come to that. Just to clarify, yeah, it does go down as a first-minute goal for Ogawa. So, yes, the 12 seconds stands. And even though, yes, the referee finally pointed to the spot at 2 minutes 45, they really wanted to kill the visitors' vibe, didn't they, by dragging it out as long as they could. But, yes, Ogawa's goal in the first minute stood. And then, yeah, Machino's brilliant equaliser in the 17th minute. There was even more action before Wada's own goal of the decade, of the century, of the ever in the 23rd minute. Yokohama FC hit the post through Shion Inoue in the 22nd minute. But, I'm sure you've seen it already, listeners. And if you haven't, well, go and track down this clip because it's, as I said earlier, it's something we'll see on blooper reels for decades to come in the 23rd minute. Takuya Wada from, he's a left back. So, yes, he's on the left side of the Yokohama FC defense. He tries to square across the box to Boniface Nduka, but instead slices into his own net on the bounce. Now, there was some rain about in Hiratsuka on Friday night. Sam, I know that because I live in the next city across, and it wasn't the nicest of weather on Friday night. But, I don't think that can really be to blame for what has done there. I don't know whether he suddenly lost himself and thought he was a striker, because if it's a finish, it's a terrific finish from a tight angle. But, it's either absolutely glorious or it's absolutely horrendous, and it's probably quite a lot of both, to be honest. But, that's my attempt at summing it up. But you were saying you just couldn't stop watching it over and over again on a loop.
Yeah, absolutely. I don't know what happened for the rest of the first half, to be honest, because this goal completely took me out of it. It's just, I'm just trying to understand, how have you done that? Why have you done that? Like, first rule of playing at the back is you don't play across your area to start with. Not necessarily that this is happening, but like, it's just, yeah, there's a bit of rain, but it's not like he slips and it scuffs in. It doesn't look like anything particularly goes wrong with his action. He's just aimed it wrong and it's headed to, and spun into the back of the net. And I really liked Onduka as he's trying to get on the end of the ball, going behind the goal, going, what are you trying to do there? You've got to try and cut it out. You're not getting on the end of a pass. So it was just glorious, just pings it into the goal. I mean, under no pressure at all. That was the other thing. Like, there was no one within about 15 yards of him. So he has all the time in the world to pick his spot. And he does that. He's got himself on the... I mean, hopefully he's on the goal sheet. I mean, I know Japan don't usually like to credit own goals, but he's got to be on there. This is just as bad an own goal as you'll see. So hopefully he's on there. But yeah, it's just absolutely ridiculous.
Yeah, remarkable stuff. And yeah, I mean, we could do a Patreon exclusive podcast on this particular moment. And who knows, that might be coming down the road for you patrons. But yeah, goodness gracious me. It left pretty much everybody shell-shocked. And yeah, Sam just watching it over and over again, which is completely understandable. But I mean, fair dues to the Yokohama FC players, because almost it equalized a minute later when Ogawa blasted only for Song Bunkyun to tip over his volley. Then in the 37th minute, this first half just that had absolutely everything, just kept delivering. And Machino hit the post when he met a corner at the back post, but fired against the woodwork from close range. He already got me one goal in the first half. I could have really used that one as well for my fantasy team. And then he had another chance shortly after that, but dinked across Kengo Nagai, but wide of the goal. Then into the second half, 10 minutes after the break, rather, Yokohama FC sub Caprini blasted too close to Song. And then in the 66th minute, Ogawa's header grazed the post. So the woodwork was struck for about the fourth time in this game. But I think you said it on Twitter, Sam. It was a big stage for Shonan on Friday night. Are they ultimately guilty of some stage fright? As they sat back in the second half and failed to kill Yokohama FC off. I don't think you could say that they underestimated their opponents, because they'd already threatened their goal so many times throughout the game to that point. And yeah, I mean, they were made to pay for not killing the game off when Ogawa rose to meet a Caprini corner and powered home his header in the 83rd minute. So yeah, ultimately, Yokohama FC, who we know gave Nagoya a decent game last week, they've impressed a lot of observers, I think, with their performance here. I mean, to shake off that wide own goal in the first place. But then, yeah, for Ogawa, who, as you said, we questioned his finishing last week, he scored two terrific goals here.
Yeah, he did. I thought, to your point about Shonan, I think second half they were really poor. And they didn't, like last week against Tosu, they were just so quick on the turnover and attacking with numbers and going for goals. And they were in this first half. So whatever reason it was in the second half, whether they were just spooked by Ogara at the other end because he looked like scoring every time he went forward, that they just sat back in, and it really had just invited pressure, and eventually Yokohama were going to score, because they should have just kept going for it. They should have kept going on the turnovers, on the counter-attacks, because Machino himself always looked like scoring. It could have been, if they carried on in that second half the way the first half was, it could have been 5-5 and Machino and Ogawa could both have had hat-tricks or 4 goals or whatever each. So it was a little disappointing, at least from a neutral, that they didn't do that. But maybe the credit all has to go to Yokohama and the pressure that they kept putting Shonan under. They controlled that second half really well. And whereas they also controlled the game against Nagoya last week, but maybe it was just that Shonan are a little more open defensively, or that there was a bit more confidence in Ogawa, because he just was unplayable. They couldn't get near him. And just like every aspect of his game, like physically very good, great in the air. And then you had that volley that you mentioned, that technique on that, the ability to just ball into feet, to running behind, absolutely everything. So it was a perfect way to answer any criticism that I had. And I hope it was just directly at me that he's turned this performance in. But yeah, I thought Yokohama deserve a lot of credit. And Shonan, yeah, maybe just, yeah, that pressure of being favourites as well. I don't know if they necessarily dealt with it as well as maybe they should have done.
Mm. Yeah. I mean, Yokohama FC supporters, I mean, they've only got 1 point to their names after two match days. But, yeah, they will be so pleased with Ogawa's performance on Friday night, because a brace and obviously threatened Song's goal on so many other occasions, and looks at home in J1 after a performance like that, which is great. As we said, he snatched at a couple of efforts last week against Nagoya, but these two goals will give him a massive boost of confidence, I'm sure. I mean, not that he needs it necessarily after 26 goals in J2 last season, but to really announce himself back in the top flight, this was a superb showing from the Yokohama FC number 18, and obviously his opposite number, Machino. A terrific goal himself, and could have been several more for him, as both Sam and I have mentioned. And he might have had another goal from the penalty spot very late on, Sam, after he himself was upended in the 85th minute, and then was standing over the ball in the 89th when VAR's judgment came down that actually in an almighty scramble in the Yokohama FC box, Tariq El-Yunusi was actually offside in the passage of play that led to Machino being upended. So I think ultimately we can agree that VAR has come to the correct decision here, even though it did take them almost an eternity.
I suppose after last week, I'm just glad they got the decision right. But why it takes forever, it's very obvious that Tariq was offside. It was quite an easy decision. But they take a sweet time getting it right, I suppose. It's right for now. It's something to build on. It's some positive. But it was a little bit, it was a great pinball wizard in there. It was a bit manic, as most of this game was. But correct decision in the end.
Indeed, and there was a chance very, very late on for Naoki Yamada, the Shonan substitute, in the 101st minute, but his low drive was saved by Nagai's outstretched leg, and both teams left with a point, a remarkable game on the stat sheet as well. The J-League has the shots 20-17 in favour of Shonan, while Google has it 22 apiece. So that just gives you an indication of how action-packed this game was. And, the punters at the Lemon Gas Stadium certainly got their money's worth, no question about that. Revisiting that clip of Taki Iwata's own goal over and over in their minds, I'm sure, even though the majority of them will have gone home frustrated that their home side did not claim the victory. All right, then. So next we'll head to Kashiwa on Sunday, where FC Tokyo were the visitors as they returned to the scene of their biggest day out in club history. The 6-3 win at Hitachidai back in match day 27 last season, when they scored the most goals in their top flight history. Adailton scored a brace on that afternoon, and he netted again for Tokyo at Hitachidai in the 36th minute. He equalised after Mao Hosoya had given Kashiwa a 25th minute lead when he drove home through the legs of Tokyo keeper Jakub Slovic after being found in stride by Mateus Savio's lovely through ball. That was Kashiwa's first shot of the match, Sam, in the 25th minute, and they were only to go on to have a total of three in the entire match day. Even though the possession was basically even, FC Tokyo were able to restrict them to, almost nothing from the time Hosoya put them in front.
Yeah, it was quite surprising given the attacking options that Kashiwa have. And you saw for their goal, the way that they can move through the lines, and Yamada into Savio, lovely pass into Hosoya. So there was the ability in that. But for whatever reason, they just couldn't break it down. I thought Tokyo in midfield were very good. And I've said a lot about Higashi, but I thought he played quite well, actually, in that holding midfield role, and having the workmanlike efforts of Koizumi and Sukugawa alongside him, I think he really worked. Because you have to make a few changes. There was no Abe in the squad. Matsuki was out with the under-20 Japan team. So had to make a few changes. But I think it was a battling midfield, and one that really won that battle. It just stopped them, Kashiwa's midfielders, really getting on the ball and creating those killer passes. So I thought Tokyo, very good there, very solid in the back line. They dealt with them. Obviously, Morishige was back on the bench here, but I think the decision to stick with Enrique and Kimoto really worked as well. So, very promising from Tokyo defensively, and not so from Kashiwa. I mean, they had an awful day at the back, and I think we're going to see a lot this season. I mean, the like in the 16th minute, the ball forward and Mitsumaro's nodded header down to Diego. I mean, what is he doing? And how Diego doesn't do better, I'm not really sure. But yeah, they got away with a lot, I thought, Cashier at the back.
Yes, indeed. Ultimately, this game's ended in frustration for a couple of different reasons for me as an FC Tokyo supporter. But I guess the die was cast in this game inside the first 50 seconds, right, Sam? As Yasuki Kimoto went into the book for a foul in the centre circle, and he was to be one of five Tokyo players to be booked in the game, and of course one of them ended up going into the referee's book twice. That was Hotaka Nakamura, who was sent off late on, which meant his team, despite dominating the second half, it had to hang on for the last 10 minutes. And any chances of Tokyo storming to victory were kind of put on the back burner as they had to hang on, even though, as we said, Reysol only mustered three shots over the course of the 90 minutes. So they weren't banging the door down at the end. But real frustration that another trip to Hitachi Dai has ended with Tokyo returning with just a point when I think three were there for the taking. But yeah, a number of spurned chances in the second half when they failed to take advantage of a patchy and shaky Reysol defense. So for me, a missed opportunity as a Tokyo supporter. I think your point's a very valid one about the way the midfield scrapped. And Sukugawa got the assist for Adalton's goal, didn't he? So I mean, he did well, as I expect him to do whenever he gets an opportunity this year. I'm not necessarily a fan of his dyed Barnett, but I think he's a terrific player, and I hope to see him play quite a bit this year. But I guess for me, frustration when I felt the 3 points were there, and then a rush of blood to the head by Hotaka Nakamura has basically put paid to any chances Tokyo had of winning.
Absolute rubbish, Nakamura. Absolutely disgusting. Well, I don't know what he's doing. The first one, I think, could be a red card anyway. It's right on the halfway line. The ball's going into centre, and he just bursts in from out of nowhere and goes through the back of him. And that's just a stupid tackle to make in that position. And then the other one, it's right on the edge of the area. The Kashima player is going nowhere. You're already on a yellow card, and you just dive in. It's just... I don't know, really, really poor from him. And he'd been given the opportunity at the start of the season. There was faith in him. You've got Nakatomo on the bench. And, he's just repaid the faith with a complete rush of blood to the head. It's really poor from him. So, he's let his team down. And because Tokyo were absolutely in the ascendancy. And once you go down to 10 men, kind of killed the momentum off. Because, as you say, I thought Tokyo were much the better team. I thought Kashima defensively were rubbish. I mean, the first goal, I know we're going back to it, but it's so bad I have to talk about it. It's a long throw-in, which Mitsumaru, who had one of the worst games I think he's ever had, he just was not watching. Sukugawa gets in. My old mate Tatsuta's in the middle, and he doesn't know where to go. And he's told, so I think we watch now, should I go to the cross? In the end, he kind of doesn't either. He eventually goes towards the cross, doesn't get anywhere near it as Sukugawa brings it across. Katayama's in the middle. I think he has to intercept it. The ball is there by his feet, and he misses it for Adele. And it's just so bad. And there were so many occasions a bit like this. There was one, poor Mitsumaru again, but I'm going for him. Higashi plays the ball forward, and Sasaki is coming out. Mitsumaru's running at it. They both see each other and just freeze. And I think it allows Nakamura in between both of them, and then he nods it wide. And there's just so many occasions where Kashima were all at sea, and for whatever, Tokyo just couldn't take advantage of it. They had the chances. Watanabe had another one. I think Henrique had a couple of headers. And I can understand the frustration from Tokyo, because that was absolutely a game that was there for them to win.
Yes, indeed. Yes, indeed. But it wasn't to be at the end of the day, and the spoils were shared. So it's two draws from two for Reysol, while Tokyo have 4 points from their opening two games. Also, two draws from two games are Gamba Osaka. They opened their campaign at the Panasonic Stadium in match day two by hosting Tosu, who, of course, were licking their wounds after their mauling at home by Shonan in match day one. And Tosu actually did the double over Gamba last year, including a 3-0 win at the Panasonic Stadium in match day 28 last season that kept Gamba right in the thick of the relegation dogfight. And, Tosu looked to shake off the disappointment of last week's hammering by starting out like a house on fire. A number of chances inside the first 5 minutes, including a stunning block by Riku Handa as he was lying on the floor to deny Wataru Harada a third-minute opener for Tosu. But basically, once the clock struck 10, as in 10 minutes into this game, Sam, it appeared that Gumba were almost always in the ascendancy until a stunning piece of play by a Tosu substitute that we'll come on to just past the hour. But yeah, Gumba absolutely dominated the chances from about the 10th minute onwards.
They did. They were in complete control, and a lot of it was coming through Osami. I think Johnny was mentioning the way that Osami was going to fit into this team. He's going to play as part of the midfield three in a bit more of a deeper role than maybe we used to, but I think it's getting the best out of him. He was involved in everything that went through, and he just controlled the game, really. He just absolutely ran it. I think it was his ball out to Yamami, which resulted in a fine save from Park, but it was just every time the ball went through him, and yeah, there was a good movement off him, and Gamba completely controlled it. There weren't as, I think Poyatos has done well, actually, in terms of, I know he's stuck in this draw kind of paradox or whatever he is, and he's not going to get away from it, but they're looking really good going forward. It's not like what I was used to with Poyatos, where it's just going sideways and a lot of possession, but possession for possession's sake. I think with Osami in there, he's got the player that could unlock a defence with one pass or one run or whatever it might be. And they really caused a lot of problems for Tosu. They had a goal correctly disallowed in the 16th minute. Miura was offside as he headed it down to Suzuki. But yeah, really just complete control on this. Tosu just about hung on. I thought Park decent in goal, and yeah, they did enough, I suppose, defensively to keep Gamba at bay for a while. But yeah, it was a really positive result necessarily for Gamba, but I thought the performance, especially before the Tosu equalised, I thought was very good.
Yeah, I mean, the chances were just raining in. I mean, you mentioned Yamami, and yes, Suzuki's a disallowed goal in the 16th minute. He had a number of other chances that Park was equal to. And yeah, Osami smashed a shot against the post with about 5 minutes to go before the break. But yeah, your point's a really interesting one on Osami. I mean, yeah, get your best player on the ball more and good things will happen. It's a fascinating concept. But yeah, it looks like one that Poyatos has landed upon. And I mean, we're used to Osami obviously still heavily involved in Gumba build-up play. But yes, more cutting in from the left. But if he's able to play deeper and see the ball a lot more, he can influence things to a higher degree. And it was terrific to see. And hopefully a sign of things to come for him this season. And terrific stuff for all Gumba supporters to look forward to. They finally got their breakthrough 6 minutes into the second half. And it was again to Miura, who was offside for Suzuki's opener, in inverted commas, in the 16th minute. And Miura headed a corner goalwards 6 minutes after the break. A Tosu defender stretched to clear, but to only knock the ball up in the air for Suzuki to blast home from close range. And this one, yes, VAR was not taking away from Gumba, and they celebrated mightily, as you'd expect, your first goal of the season at home. But what can you say about this equaliser, Sam? I think we saw the clubhouse leader for goal of the season last week in a game involving Tosu. And of course, it was Kosuke Onose, formerly of Gumba, who scored it. I don't know what you think. It depends what you think about a technical dribbler's type of goal versus a volley from the edge of the box. I mean, Shiotani's goal was an absolute screamer, wasn't it, this week? So some might even have that in pole position after match day two. But Ryunosuke Kabayama, it's a mouthful, but we might have to get used to saying it a lot more, his name a lot more on this podcast, Sam, because what an absolute stunner it was when he picked the ball up on the right side of the box, sent one man to the floor and nutmegged another before a blasting high past Korsetani at his near post. An absolute special.
Magnificent. Marinos must be hoping they've put a buyback clause in it, because I don't know why he's left them. That's what a goal. And this is my clubhouse leader. I love both other goals. And honestly, it brings back memories, I suppose. Shiotani's was a fantastic strike. great technique from a centre back, but this one, it just, he picks the ball up, he skins one, he makes another, he then rolls past a third, and then his strike is no backlift. I mean, Tanny is past him before he can even recognise that Kaveyama's shot. It's just such a good goal. It's just, yeah, brilliant technique, brilliant movement. It was just, yeah, magnificent. And just like Wilder's needs to be watched over and over again, this one does as well. It's just incredible technique, a fantastic goal. And yeah, I don't know if you agree, but he's my clubhouse leader, Kaveyama.
Yeah, I tell you what, it's tight. I tell you what, if Emil Salomonsson's listening, we might let him have a vote, because Shio Tani's goal, as I said, it evoked Salomonsson's goal for Hiroshima so many years ago. So if Emil reckons that Shio Tani's is the best one so far, then I'll plump with that for that one. But I don't blame you at all for choosing Kabayama. It's an absolutely spectacular goal, and yeah, as we say, hopefully a sign of things to come for Tosu supporters. Just 3 minutes after Kabayama's equaliser, Keiman Togashi scored a terrific goal, but he was flagged for offside and just by a hair. And again, that decision stood after a VAR review. So I guess, like a couple of other ones in this week's match day, it's one that looks level to me on the replay. But again, I'm not seeing the best line alongside the pitch. So I felt Togashi was a little bit hard done to. But again, VAR hopefully sees it a lot clearer than we do and came to the right decision that the linesman hadn't made a mistake. And I guess the game ended in a little bit of, well, not controversy, but disappointment and frustration for Gumba and their supporters, Sam, when the 5 minutes of second half stoppage time were well and truly up, but Gumba were ready to take a corner only for the referee to blow full time. So I guess, yeah, Kabayama's goal took a little bit of wind out of their sails, and they were hoping for a spectacular ending to this game, but it wasn't to be, obviously.
Yeah, time had expired, and referee is within his rights to blow up. It always feels harsh when an attacking team has a set piece and you think they should be allowed to take it. But yeah, I think, in fact, if I was a referee, not definitely against Gamba, but I think I'd annoy teams by blowing up a set piece. So yeah, fair play to the referee for that, I suppose.
Okay, fair enough then. So yeah, all nine games then from match day two rounded up. And yes, just before we leave you on this week's episode, listeners, let's briefly look ahead to J1 match day three. Correct me if I'm wrong, Sam. I don't think there's really any question about what the best game of the weekend on paper is. But Friday night's clash at the Nissan Stadium between Yokohama F. Marinos and Hiroshima looks the standout fixture to me, as I mentioned earlier, between the two teams I expect to fight out the top flight title. So presuming you agree with me, what would Sam's pick of Saturday be then?
Sam's pick of Saturday.
Yeah, this is a really tough call because there are several games that I'm, like Vissel versus Gamba, a good Kansai derby. They're always exciting. There's Kawasaki against Shonan. Are we going to see a repeat of the greatest result ever with Shonan from last week? But assuming that they're givens, their derbies are going to be exciting. The other one I'd say would be Yokohama versus Kashima. I think that should be a really exciting game. I think Yokohama at home, they should be spurred on by their performance this week, and Kashima licking their wounds a little bit about how it went down against Kawasaki. So I think that's a fascinating game, should be really exciting. But yeah, anything that does Kyoto Tokyo, is that in any way a derby historically?
I guess between the two cities, the most recent capital cities of Japan. So yes, I guess if any organization can spin it, the J League could probably spin it into some kind of derby. I have bad memories of going to Kyoto, not myself personally to watch the game, but watching on TV. Of course, FC Tokyo were relegated after losing at Kyoto on the final day of the 2010 season. But then we had a smidgen of revenge by defeating them in the Emperor's Cup final at the end of 2011. Still, of course, the only all J2 Emperor's Cup final to this point. Kyoto supporters probably won't like me reminding them of that. But we had to get some sort of revenge after they took us down with them at the end of 2010. But yeah, hopefully a chance for Tokyo to go away from home and come back with a victory after, as we said, they were frustrated on Sunday at Kashiwa. For me, yeah, I mean, Niigata Sapporo looks really exciting and really interesting, because Niigata have looked terrific so far and Sapporo have looked anything but. But we know they are capable of flicking a switch, and yeah, that should be a fascinating game. And also, yeah, I think Reds Cerezo has a lot riding on it as well. Yes, it's still too early, but yeah, it's the only clash actually on the slate between the two teams that have yet to win so far this season. So yeah, a lot on the line. And did I say earlier on in the episode it was going to be at Saitama Stadium? Because it's not. It's actually at Komaba. So that'll be a really interesting atmosphere in and of itself. Obviously less of a behemoth than a Saitama Stadium. But yeah, Reds playing their home opener there on Saturday is one of the eight games that will finish up the match day after that blockbuster on Friday night. All right, Sam. So, yes, we went guestless this week, but yeah, I think we've done a terrific job, if I do say so myself, of rounding up all of the match day two action, the big talking points. I think I probably forgot to drop in this week in VARDROP, but I'm sure you'll forgive me for that, listeners. But yeah, Sam, I think we'll be guested up next week to chat about one or more of the big derbies on the slate. So looking forward to that.
Yeah, absolutely. It's always good to have a guest on. I think we've rocked and rolled pretty well here. Hopefully there's not too much work for you to do in the editing room. And yeah, before I forget, actually, and you reminded me there by mentioning Komaba, Reds' ACL final has been finalised. They've got the small task of Al Hilal in the final, who won 7-0 against Michael Olunga's Al-Dahail in the semi-final on Sunday. So yeah, it's going to be a difficult one over two legs. I'm not necessarily sure I'm fancying Reds' chances looking at that performance. But yeah, they're there. It should be a fascinating couple of games. I think the first leg is the end of April. I think it's the 29th. So hopefully Saitama's ready for that, if it's not for this weekend.
Yes, thank you for mentioning that. Yes, and well, yeah, Maciej Skorża has definitely got something to work towards now that the final is set, and yeah, he'll hope to get his first win under his belt as Reds boss this Saturday, and then yeah, to build his team up to that that huge event, no question about that. All right then, so yeah, that's it for this week's episode of the J-Talk podcast. Sam and I would like to thank all of our patrons for their ongoing support, especially David, who came in on board in the past week, and we also had the welcome returns of Jonathan and Peter to our Patreon ranks. It's great to have those two back with us as well. If you'd like to get involved for as little as $1 a month, please visit patreon.com/JTalkPod. And of course, listeners, we'd like to thank you for listening wherever you are. We'll be back next week to round up all of the action from J1 Match Day 3. Speak to you next week. Bye for now.
The J-Talk Podcast. Yosh, 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 yosh.